Hello, good evening, good day. Welcome to the 16th episode of the Indian Interest Podcast. I hope you're all doing very well. We're going to discuss a number of things today. Very important and interesting things are going on in the world of geopolitics, in international relations. We're going to discuss that. But before we do that, let me greet you all. Let's see who all is there on the live chat. I can see Vidhan, Piyush, Prasad, Manmath, Ashish, Srinivas, Deba Mandal, Kelvin, Nisarg, Sharang, Rahul, Bhanu Prakash, Akarshan, Durga, Ashwin, Yuvraj, Arsh, Vladimir Putin, Davaldeep Gaur, Malhar, Samudragupta, Rishi, Nirbhay, Jamtani, Jay Prakash, Abhay, Asmanor, Karan Nalavat, Akash Kumar Singh, Atharva Pranav, Shiva Prasad, Manmath, Matteo Perez, Akash Dikshit, Abhinav, GK, Somye, Saurabh, Trupti, Dude, Akarsh, Siddhant, Aditi, Librando Detector, Melvin, Sam Bid, Uday Pratap Singh, Vineet Krishna, Sai Aditya, Raja Kumar, Tiyasha Haldar, Vinod Khanna, Chewingam, Shriyansh, Arsh, Niku, Om, Tejashri, Jai, Atharva, and lots of other people. Good evening, good day, all of you, wherever you are. I hope you're doing great. So what shall we discuss? I think we should start where we should start, which is the most important thing that's happened in the past week, which is the incident along the India-Tibet border, Chinese-occupied Tibet, around in Arunachal Pradesh, right? So let's see the news report. What does the news report say? Yes, let's discuss this. What's going on here? So Arunachal Pradesh, over 200 people's enslavement army groups came with spiked clubs and taser guns and all that, and Indian soldiers hit back. So the Chinese were attempting to cross over into the Indian side of the LAC, and they were initially challenged by 50 Indian soldiers before Indian backup arrived, and that outnumbered the PLA troops and overwhelmed them. And there was a scuffle, they were armed with spiked clubs with nails on them, monkey fists and taser guns and all that. That's what the Chinese had. And the Indians were suitably well prepared. Yeah, supposedly crude weapons. So that's what the print says. And the Hindu says Indian Chinese soldiers injured in clash near Arunachal border. Where did this happen? It's showing the location. It says the tense Yangtze area. And over here also, I'm sure it says Yangtze. The first thing I would like to say is that why do Indian publications, why does the Indian media use Chinese names? Why does it call this area the Yangtze area? Yangtze is a Chinese name. The region that we are talking about is Arunachal Pradesh, which is India, and Tibet. Tibet doesn't have Chinese names. Lhasa isn't a Chinese name, right? So, and the Chinese have recently given Chinese names to various places. Why does the Indian media have to parrot those Chinese names? Why can't we use the actual proper names? Or maybe the Indian media is ignorant and they know nothing. They're simply copy-pasting what the Chinese have reported. So this is very unfortunate. It is very disappointing on the part of the print and the Hindu. But yeah, it's not surprising. It's disappointing. It's unfortunate, but it is not surprising. Very poor reporting. Yangtze. Why do we have to call it Yangtze? Yangtze is a Chinese name. Anyhow, so that's what happened. And there were some fractures, apparently. It says a few soldiers sustained fractured limbs, which means that the injuries are not insignificant. Fractures are not... A fracture is not a small injury. Yeah, so that's what happened. It says around 600 Chinese soldiers were present where the clashes took place and so on. So there are various kinds of reports that have come out. That's the thing. And then there's this viral clip that suddenly made its appearance in social media. A clip that clearly took place about a year ago, because that's a clip of Indian and Chinese soldiers clashing on the LAC. And it's very clear that the Indians gave the Chinese quite a pummeling, quite a beating. And there's this wonderful Punjabi commentary in the background and so on. Yeah, so this this video clip went viral worldwide. Yeah, the in the West they found it amusing that these two nuclear powers, they have agreed by mutual consensus to fight only with melee weapons, not even range weapons, no sharp weapons. At most, you will fight with stones and sticks and clubs with pointed sticks and pointed nails or whatever, and things like that, right? So the Indians use a variety of weapons, the Chinese use a variety of weapons, and I think firing is not allowed. And yet the Chinese on a couple of times have actually used firearms, maybe in the air or whatever. No Indian has received gunshot wounds, but that's what's happening. So the world has been quite amused to see this new clip that suddenly appeared on social media. And there are interesting Chinese reactions that have come out. How the Chinese reacting? So the Chinese speak about, why do we need to fight a war against India? We have a political party ruling over us for 70 years. How immature is it for them to rely on border conflicts to divert attention from other problems? This is what the Chinese people are saying on Chinese social media. Yes, there are too many internal conflicts and this looks like a distraction. The Russian media is referring to the point of conflict as Arunachal Pradesh and not South Tibet. The Russian media is trying to sabotage the friendship between China and Russia. So various kinds of reactions. Why do we wait for foreign media to report this? India's economic growth rate is the highest among all major countries and it will not want a war now, which may affect its growth prospects. Last time he said there were no deaths for PLA and only India had casualties. This time you said no casualties on both sides. What is the truth? We must first fix internal issues before fighting enemies outside. India always releases news reports quickly, but the Chinese try to hide the news. Our media to Xi Jinping, it says, oh, leader, how can we report? Can we report this? And how do we report this? Here it says, it looks like a well-planned combination of punches for China. The U.S. recently sanctioned former officials of the Tibet Autonomous Region. Then a Chinese hotel was targeted in Afghanistan. Beijing is seeing a peaking of the epidemic again. Diplomatic attacks on China by foreign agencies. And now this border skirmish. No word on PLA casualties and so on and so forth. Lots and lots of Chinese reactions, which kind of tell you the state of mind among the Chinese people, right? So that's what's happening. So the Chinese seem to be disappointed. The Chinese citizens seem to be disappointed by what's happened. Yes, it is clear that the Chinese army has suffered a lot of injuries here. It cannot defeat the Indian army. Chinese soldiers are basically in the army to support their families and earn money. How can child soldiers who have the military spirit to fight and win wars? Let us check and report the number of casualties for the PLA and so on and so forth. So if the Chinese people are able to understand that there is this situation going on within China, this incredible peaking of the COVID-19 or COVID whatever it is, pandemic. There are lots of internal problems in China right now, lots of dissent, lots of frustration among the population. It's a very rebellious attitude. Yes, there is this, the economy is not doing well. The real estate sector, it's a big bubble that's kind of crumbling right now. Lots of economic and other social problems, law and order problems, the pandemic problems, so many problems within China. So the Chinese citizens are saying that the Chinese government, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, Mr. Xi Jinping, they are trying to divert our attention from the real issues at home by creating this problem with India. That's what the Chinese citizens kind of are feeling. And they are not really trusting what the Chinese are saying. The Chinese are saying that there were casualties on both sides, injuries. But what is the truth? Because the last time it was clear the Chinese suffered more casualties in the Galwan clash than the Indian side. And the Chinese media, they hid this for a very long time. Eventually, the truth came out and the Chinese kind of lost a bit of trust in the government. So these are the Chinese reactions. The Chinese reactions are very different from the Western reactions. The Western reactions are more like, you know, they are amused about the fact that two nuclear powers are fighting with sticks and stones. The Chinese, they have very different reactions and they are quite concerned and they are kind of expressing their reluctance to believe the official reports in the Chinese media and what's given out by the Chinese Communist Party. So that is the situation vis-a-vis the how the world is reacting to this. Now, what has actually happened? So we know that our defense minister, Mr. Rajnath Singh, gave a statement in parliament in which he has laid out the official version of what happened, that there was this clash and the Indian side was very firm and resolute, and there were some injuries on both sides, but nothing serious. Yeah. The rumors, though, say that something else has happened. So this, let's put this on the screen. So this is a Twitter account that is followed by lots of very serious journalists. Yeah. So this is not some random anonymous Twitter account. This is a Twitter account that has a good standing among the military and OSINT and journalistic circles. So let's see what it says here. One, Mago marks the southern entrance of the valley and Chuna the northern end of it, bordering the LAC, the line of actual control. Steep mountainous terrain which needs hours of trekking to reach the posts. And okay, peak XXX sits to the west of this area and has a commanding view of the ridges and tracks across the LAC deep into Kona County, which is the Chinese occupied territory. The PLA sent in roughly 300 troops with melee weapons, with a clear intention to kill or maim the Indian army troops holding the area. So this was a deliberate action by the Chinese. It was initiated by the Chinese. It was not some accidental meeting of the two armies. This was deliberately initiated by the Chinese, right? Closely placed echelons on the lower ridges in the river valley were quickly able to reinforce the 50 Indian troops firmly facing the PLA onslaught, and reinforcements poured in from multiple directions immediately after being radioed, right? What started with abuses and stone pelting gradually progressed to fisticuffs, you know, and then fierce hand-to-hand combat, where the PLA troops were overpowered and in some cases their weapons were used against them. This free-for-all went on until the PLA found itself losing ground, with many of their troops overpowered and battered, while Indian army troops kept pouring in with their own melee weapons. Things went south from there and the PLA troops started falling back. The Indian army troops were in no mood to relent and went after the retreating PLA troops, who were running for their lives after having borne the brunt of the counter-attack. Gunshots were heard from the PLA's rear as they attempted to deter further assault. So that the things got desperate for the PLA. And this entire thing happened on their perceived side of the LAC. Once they started, falling back. The area of the face-off has been reinforced and the units in the vicinity are on a high state of alert, which means the Indian side. All in all, a very comprehensive drubbing for the PLA, with a dozen plus of their troops dead or extremely critical, which means skulls opened or crushed. Now, there is no government confirmation of this account. There is no Chinese confirmation of this account, and you will not find any confirmation of this. But this is an interesting, you could say, revelation over here, right? Because because this account, this gentleman, is highly regarded in defense and OSINT, open source intelligence matters, and lots of very prominent defense journalists follow this account. So this is what possibly could have happened. There is no confirmation of this, but here is an interesting perspective of what happened. Now the question is, what's going on? We know that just a few weeks ago, Prime Minister Modi spoke briefly with President Xi Jinping in Bali. There was a Bali G20 summit where this happened. It was in the middle of November, 15, 16 November, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And it was Prime Minister Modi who took the initiative to go and speak with President Xi Jinping. So Mr. Modi decided to take the initiative and try and defuse tensions that had been simmering since the 2020 Galwan clash, which again the Chinese had initiated. Yes. So Mr. Modi took the initiative to try and kind of lower the tensions because the past 2 years there was no interaction between the two leaders, even in the central, I think it was in Tashkent or Samarkand or wherever the SCO summit happened. The two leaders did not even acknowledge each other. They did not even nod at each other or say hello or whatever. No shake hands, nothing. Like, they don't see each other. That sort of relationship was going on. So in Bali, Mr. Modi took the initiative, and then the reaction to that very quickly has been this Chinese essentially attempt to intrude upon Indian territory and try to kill Indian soldiers, yeah, with melee weapons. So that's been the response. So what is the deal? Why is this happening? What are the Chinese intentions? This is clearly a provocation that was initiated by the Chinese. The Indians did not initiate this. So, once again, let me draw your attention to something I had said a long time ago, not very long ago, in March 4, 2022. I said that India needs to prepare for a short, sharp 1962-like conflict with China. Could happen before 2024 or in 2024. The Chinese objective will be to inflict a quick military defeat on India, to bisect India, maybe in the Siliguri corridor somewhere there. That would be the Chinese objective. And that could possibly, the Chinese would hope that could cause the current government, the Modi government, to lose the 2024 election. Because if a government, which is a nationalistic government, suffers a defeat, then that defeat is blamed on the leadership. And then people lose trust in that government. That's what typically happens. You can give any kind of argument, but that is how it happens. That is how it goes. The Indian people are an emotional people, and they will say that the leadership has made a huge mess of things, and now we need to change, vote somebody for somebody else. And like I said, all indications are that the US anticipates the possibility of such a short, sharp war between India and China. So India must be ready. This is what I had said at that time. This is in March. This is right after the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, right? So, and why did I say that the US anticipates this? It's because the US had already unleashed this wave of social media attacks on India via its various think tank experts and journalists, the people I call disposable minions, various people for hire. Typically people who work in think tanks, people who are journalists. So let me show you some examples of what was being said at the time. There was a relentless assault, social media assault on India. Here's one example. This person, Robert Shrimsley, whoever it is. This is a person from the UK, chief UK political commentator, Financial Times. He says that India's abstention is a useful wake-up call to those in the West taking it up as a part of the alliance of democratic countries they want to build. Yeah. Here's another. Edward Luce. Who is Edward Luce? Associate editor, Financial Times, US-based person. Whatever the calculations, misplaced loyalties or misjudgments, India is at risk of abdicating its respect as one of the world's leading democracies. Yeah. Here's more. Derek Grossman, who belongs to Rand Corporation or who works for Rand Corporation. India abstains at the UN again, this time on something as anodyne as discussing human rights in Ukraine. Icky stuff. Icky. India is so icky. Yeah, that's what he says. Derek Grossman. Then here is Jeff Smith, who a lot of Indians seem to admire a lot and love a lot for some reason, because sometimes he says good things about India. Here's what he says. I understand, and I have tried to explain, the Indian government's bind regarding Russia and the Ukraine crisis. Most folks seem to get it. What I can't sympathize with is Indian commentators gleefully spouting Russian propaganda and cheering on Putin. You took the wrong pill, comrades. That's what this gentleman has to say. Here's more. Andrew Gwynne, whatever, UK, I guess. We have an urgent question following the Prime Minister's trade visit to India. This was in April. The PM couldn't be bothered to turn up. I asked about human rights abuses, alleged, this is what they claim. These people have always claimed this, to pressurize India about Kashmir and all that nonsense. Clauses on human rights will be included in the deal and so on. Here is Anne Applebaum. I guess she's from the Atlantic. India, South Africa, two large democracies abstain. Shameful, shameful, right? So these are just a few examples of what happened. So the US, the West, unleashed this enormous wave of propaganda that sought to portray India, to paint India as a nation that sides with the aggressor, with Russia, a nation that doesn't deserve to have any respect, a nation that is undemocratic, a nation that has human rights abuses, all that nonsense. The same old stereotypes that they've been spouting for decades. So they unleashed this all over again in February, March, April, and so on this year. Yes, slowly over time, it's kind of toned down, but the intention of this, most likely, is to condition the Western mind, the mind of the gullible, average intelligence Western person, it's to condition their mind and prepare them mentally for the possibility that if India and China go to war, then the West will stay out of it. And they will say that you don't deserve to be helped. They will tell India that you should have stood on our side when it came to Ukraine. So now that you are at war with China for whatever reason, we will not stand on your side. And we will throw you under the bus. Yeah. So they were at that time mentally preparing the West for the possibility that they would abandon India and refuse to support India, despite India being a democracy, against the authoritarian communist Chinese dictatorship, if India and China were to clash or go to war, right? So I had said that there could be a short, sharp war with China before 2024. It still could happen, yes? And why? So the strange thing is that there is a great deal of convergence between the US and China vis-a-vis the Modi government. Neither the US nor China is very happy about the fact that there is a very strong nationalistic government with a strong and independent, robust foreign policy in India. The US would like to see a Manmohan Singh type of government in India, which was very pliable and which was very malleable. They essentially did whatever the Americans told them. An extremely weak-kneed foreign policy and even internal policy. Even the Chinese like the Manmohan Singh kind of government in India, because that gives them a great deal of advantage. It is not in their interest, whether it's the US or China, to have someone like Narendra Modi in power in India. So there's a great deal of convergence when it comes to India, to the US and China, in how they regard and what their opinion of this government is. Neither wants this government to last. And that's why it is in the interest of the US and in the interest of China to see the Modi government maybe lose the election in 2024. Right? So the US, we know that it, and the US also wants to punish India for having an independent foreign policy, for in the Ukraine war especially, and for buying Russian oil, lots of Russian oil, and for refusing to condemn and sanction China, and for essentially having a very strong and independent foreign policy. Yeah. So that's why we had all these Twitter attacks by the disposable minions of the US. Both the US and China want to see Modi fail in 2024. Yeah. I said this, that there could be, and then we know what the US started doing, right? The American ambassador in Pakistan started referring to the illegally Pakistani occupied portion of Jammu and Kashmir as Azad, so-called Azad Kashmir. Yeah. So they started taking the Pakistani side, and just 2-3 weeks after Dr. Jaishankar visited the Pentagon, we had the visit of this person, Bajwa, Khamar Javed Bajwa, the chief of the Pakistani army. He went to the same place, Pentagon, and he was given a very warm welcome by the Americans. And they discussed their long-standing defense partnership and areas of mutual interest, right? So I said, what are the areas of mutual interest? Essentially, countering India's peaceful rise. What else? So I said, expect a US rapprochement with Xi Jinping next, sooner or later after this month's CCP 20th National Congress. I said, I'm not kidding. This was on October 5. Yeah. So in October, you had the Chinese Communist Party's 20th National Congress. Then you had the Bali Summit. And then I said, just a couple of days ago, that this US-China rapprochement is most likely happening right now as we speak. Why did I say this? Because these pieces of news then emerged. US delegates in China talk on improving ties, and they talk on Taiwan. This was on December 12. US-China talks took place on Sunday and Monday last weekend, in the northern province of Hebei, Beijing said. And they discussed ways to improve ties, the issue of Taiwan, and they laid the groundwork for a planned visit by Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, and so on. And more senior US officials visit China, hold talks with Vice Foreign Minister. And the talks were apparently frank, in-depth, and constructive. Yes? So it looks like there is a rapprochement between the US and China that could possibly happening be happening right now. Why would the Americans want to shake hands with the Chinese and come to some sort of agreement, some sort of rapprochement? The reason for that is that the US no longer fears China's imminent rise. Take a look at this. China's economy will not overtake the US until 2060, if ever. Yes, the consensus that Beijing can achieve whatever target it sets ignores the pace of slowdown in recent years. Yeah. Xi Jinping's goal is to make China a mid-level developed country in the next decade, which implies that the economy will need to expand at a rate of around 5% per year. But underlying trends, bad demographics, heavy debt, and declining productivity growth suggest that the country's overall growth rate is about half of that. China is most likely growing at 2.5%. The last couple of years, it may have actually, the GDP growth may possibly have been in the negative numbers, you know. It may have shrunk. And the best case scenario is that China's economy will be growing at 2.5%. And there are lots of demographic issues, social issues. The population is very rapidly becoming really old. It is aging, yeah. So if you assume that the US grows at 1.5%, with similar rates of inflation and stable exchange rate, China would not overtake America as the world's largest economy until 2060, if ever. So this is the situation. And I've spoken about this multiple times, but then I found this news report. So what's happened is that China's great growth story has stopped. The pandemic destroyed it. The pandemic essentially destroyed China's growth. The economy is now very stagnant. There are lots of problems, huge debt. There's this banking bubble, the real estate bubble in China, aging population, declining growth everywhere, declining exports, declining production, lots and lots of problems, these constant never-ending lockdowns. Yep. And the pandemic ensured that the BRI, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, it essentially became stagnant. It's no longer, there's no progress on that. Yeah. So that's what's happened. And India contributed greatly to this. The Chinese were hoping that the Russians will become a Chinese vassal state after February 24th, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That did not happen because India started purchasing enormous quantities of Russian oil. So Russia did not have to go begging to China for help. The Russians were able to manage without becoming a Chinese vassal. So the Chinese gained nothing out of the pandemic or from the Ukraine invasion, right? So China is no longer on the path to becoming a superpower anytime soon. China is merely the great power in Asia, one of two or three great powers, India, Russia, China. Yeah. So the Americans no longer fear China's imminent rise. And the Americans would prefer to keep dealing with one major rival, China, and the Americans do not want to see the emergence of a new rival, India. So they want to keep India down, and they would like to keep cooperating with China and come to an agreement that we will both work together to keep India down and Russia down. And that sort of thing could be happening. That's what I mean by a US-China rapprochement. Now, the Chinese economy is now struggling very badly. The BRI is stagnant, dead in the water, like I've said. But the Chinese obviously will not give up. The Chinese will not give up. Why should they just lie down and die? They will fight. The Chinese will fight. They will not give up. Xi Jinping wants to resurrect the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, in some way or some shape or some form, right? And recently we had the China Arab Summit just this week, right? Xi Jinping went to Saudi Arabia. He met with the various leaders of the Arab world. He met with Mohammed bin Salman. He met with King Salman as well. There were more than 30 agreements between China and Saudi Arabia. And we also have the China-Iran deal, which was signed a year or so ago. Yes, a $400 billion investment of Chinese investment into Iran. Yeah, in exchange for a steady supply of oil from Iran, yes. So the Chinese are going to keep pushing. They're going to keep fighting. And they may get US help in this because the Americans are not happy with the possibility of India's rise, because India is now showing a very independent foreign policy. India is showing that we will not be cowed down and beaten back. We will not toe your line. We will do what is best for us. Yeah. So that's what's happening. Now the question is, what about BRICS? Yeah. So what about BRICS from the perspective of China? BRICS is about China first. The Chinese will put their interests first. The when you create a coalition or confederation of nations, you create it for your own interest, not for the interest of the overall community. So for China, BRICS is about China first. They care about China. And if BRICS no longer serves the purpose, then they will keep it alive, but they will then negotiate with various countries one-to-one. So that's what was the China-Saudi Arabia thing was. That this was not a BRICS and Saudi Arabia meeting. This was a China-Saudi Arabia meeting. So the Chinese will put their interests first, not the BRICS interests first. So they will be very happy, the Chinese, to bypass BRICS altogether and use BRICS in whatever way suits them best, in whatever way favors them, but they will always put their interests first. And when it comes to China, they are in a position to purchase a lot more oil from the Saudis than India can. Yeah, so that would obviously offer the Saudis an incentive to make well with China, to, you know, that. So that's the deal. So BRICS is not that important for China. They will use BRICS for in a variety of ways that favor them, but it's all about China first. Now, what about Russia? Well, Russia, the truth is that Russia needs China more than Russia needs India. China is much more powerful. It has got much more money, much deeper pockets. And Russia also has the problem that Russia shares a long, long border with China. That's always an issue, right? So Russia needs China more than Russia needs India. On the other hand, Russia needs India to counterbalance China. So there is this tug of war going on, and that's the deal. But we have to remember this, my friends. Let me put that on the screen, what I had said. Remember this, India has no allies. I have been saying this for the past 2-3 weeks. I've been showing you documentary evidence that India has no allies. There are no friends in geopolitics. How many times have I said this? Please understand that. Stop having some kind of love, one-sided love or one-sided soft corner for some nation. There are no friends in geopolitics. And right now, India doesn't even have allies. An alliance is something that you take forward on a long-term basis. India doesn't even have allies right now. And that's fine. The truth is that Russia cannot help India if there's a war with China. And neither can or will Japan or Israel. And USA, UK, NATO, Australia, the liberal democracies, they will watch from the sidelines and they all want India to fail. So India is on its own, which is fine. India is no longer a tiny, miserable little country. You know, India is now a great power on its own right, a small great power. It's not a regional power or a medium power. India is now a great power because of a variety of reasons. So India needs to ensure, what is this? Sorry. So India needs to keep on working towards. So the question now is, if India has no friends, if India has no allies, if BRICS, all these things are happening, then what should India do? What should India do? So I had put out a number of things over here. Let me just add something. So first of all, India may need to increase its military budget. So right now, you know, India's military budget is less than 3% of India's GDP. If you look at a nation like Israel, it's almost 6% of the GDP. So I would say that India needs to maybe double, possibly, its military budget. Obviously, that will mean that we will have to cut corners somewhere else. Maybe, you know, cut down on expenditure in other areas. But yeah, you know, it may be necessary. So I think one of the things India can do is increase the military budget, maybe bring it to around 5% of GDP. That would be great. Right now, it's less than 3%. So maybe around 5% of GDP so that we can invest more money in acquiring, more military muscle. The other thing India could do is acquire some strategic bombers from Russia. The Tupolev 160, that was Blackjack that we spoke about, sometime last week. So acquire strategic bombers. It will give India more options. It's to be used as a deterrent against China. So right now, the one option that we have is ballistic missiles to keep China in check. You know, we have this thing and you need to behave. But if we have strategic bombers, it gives you more options, different ways of delivering a nuclear payload. We never want to do that, but the option has to be available. So maybe India should acquire that package of 6 Tupolev 160 strategic bombers from Russia, like they've been talking about. They should not talk for the next 5 to 10 years. If you're going to do it now. Get it done quickly, maybe in the next year or so. Because you'll need to train pilots and all that. So it may take a year or so. get it done. Get those Tupolev 160 strategic bombers, that package of six bombers. That would be fantastic. It will give India lots of options in a variety of ways. What else should India do? India should learn the lessons of the Ukraine war. First of all, the Ukraine war, the Artsakh conflict, the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict, loitering munitions, suicide drones, these are going to play a big role in warfare. That is for mainly for tactical uses. But also, the other thing we have seen in the Ukraine war is that Russia has needed lots and lots and lots of cruise missiles. Yeah, you don't want to, the Russians have decided consciously not to use their air force to do bombing strikes in Ukraine. They have relied only on cruise missiles. That way, they are able to safeguard that air force, that huge air force that they have, for a future larger conflict. The Ukraine conflict is a proxy war with NATO. But in the future, the Russians may have to get into a real war with NATO. For that, they will need their air force to be intact. So they don't want to risk much of the air force in open combat or operations over Ukraine. So they are relying only on cruise missiles, on a variety of cruise missiles. Yeah. And they must have used up thousands of cruise missiles by now, since the end of February, right? So the lesson, one of the major lessons from the Ukraine conflict is that if you want to fight a war that may take a long time, several months, you need lots and lots of cruise missiles. You know, 50 BrahMos missiles will not do it, or 200 BrahMos missiles will not do it. And once again, it's wrong to rely only on one kind of cruise missile. The BrahMos is a supersonic cruise missile, Mach 2 cruise missile. You also want to have different kinds of cruise missiles. Maybe the, what's it called? The Nirbhay cruise missile, which has a range of, I don't know, what is it? 1500 kilometers? Something like that. It's a subsonic cruise missile. But you need multiple kinds of cruise missiles and you need them in large quantities. I would say that India needs to have a stockpile of about 10,000 cruise missiles of various kinds. So that is another thing India needs to work on. For that, you will need an expanded military budget. And then, obviously, you also want to diversify your ballistic missile inventory. We have the Agni 5. We have a whole spectrum of Agni missiles and Prithvi missiles. We also have the Agni Prime. The Agni 5 has an almost intermediate or ballistic or intercontinental range. We need to fit those missiles onto submarines. We need the submarine launched equivalence of all these missiles. So especially the K-5 missile, which has the same range as the Agni 5 missile, we need to quickly, very rapidly develop it if it is not yet developed, and we need to fit that missile and make it operational, yeah, on submarines. So if you have that, then you can launch a missile, if ever required, from any place in the Bay of Bengal or any other part of the world. If you are in a submarine, you can launch it from anywhere, and you know that gives you a whole lot of options if you have that. And of course, we need more submarines. Now, right now, India has what, 15 submarines, 17 submarines? I'm not sure. That is woefully inadequate. If you want to have 20 submarines deployed at any given point in time, you need 60 submarines in total. And this may sound very strange and counterintuitive to you. Here is a secret. It's not a secret. If any naval person will know this. If you have 60 naval assets, only if you have X number of naval assets, only one third of them can be deployed actively at any given point in time. Let's say you have 3 ships. Out of those 3 ships, one will be actively deployed somewhere. One will be at the port undergoing refits or refueling or whatever it is, and one will be either going towards deployment or coming back from its old deployment. So only out of 3, only one at any given point in time is actively deployed. So if India wants to have 20 submarines actively deployed at all times, India needs to invest in at least 60 submarines for that to happen. That is how it goes in the naval world, right? So India needs more submarines. And I would say that India should invest in cheaper submarines. Why invest in submarines that cost $1 billion? Try and acquire submarines that cost $100 million. Cheap, you know. I'm sure that it's easier said than done, of course. Yeah, but we need to find ways of doing this. For instance, the Gotland class Swedish submarine costs just $100 million. Yeah, it is it is quite cheap, you know, relatively speaking. So, of course, the Swedes are, well, they will not be so inclined to sell submarines to India and so on. So, but India needs to find ways and means of doing this. So we need SSNs, we need SSKs, SSNs, nuclear submarines for deterrence and all that. We also, India also needs more surface vessels. The Indian Ocean is key to India's security. We cannot allow the Chinese to become a major force in the Indian Ocean region. So we need more surface vessels, lot more surface vessels. The Chinese Navy is already the largest navy in the world numerically. It's not necessarily the most powerful navy, but it is the largest navy. So India needs lots of submarines. India needs more surface vessels. India needs to distribute its lethality, not concentrate lethality in large ships. Yeah. And of course, India needs to focus on indigenization of its military. And what is distributed lethality? The number of ways in which you can, I mean, how you distribute your lethality. And what is lethality? The strength of a navy is not the number of ships that it can deploy. The strength of a navy, the true measure of a navy's strength or lethality is how many missiles it can deploy, offensive missiles it can deploy at any given point in time. That is a true strength of a navy's lethality. So we need to distribute our lethality. We need to have a lot more missiles on ships and all that. We need indigenization of the military. We need to, like I've said 100 million times before now, we need to reach a $10 trillion economy as soon as possible. We need minimum 7 to 8% growth of our economy year on year for the next 10, 20 years. And we need to have peace anyhow for at least a decade. If we can maintain peace for a decade, then, you know, we'll be able to achieve these objectives. And we, obviously, India needs to balance the US and China and Russia and other nations, cooperate with like-minded non-English speaking countries, and to keep Uncle Sam placated and mollified. So these are the things India needs to do. It's very easy to say this. It's very easy to verbalize this. It's very hard to actually do it. But, well, if you want to be a great nation once again, like you've always been, we need to find ways of doing this. So that's where India is. That's the whole deal with China. China is always, I have said this a million times, India can never, ever trust China. The only long-term solution to India-China peace is the freedom of Tibet. There is no other option. So India needs, over the next 20, 30 years, to find a way of liberating Tibet. India and China were coexisted for 3,000 years. India has existed for 10,000 plus years. China is about 3,000 years old, maybe 3,500 years old, if you want to be charitable to them. India and China have never been enemies. China has absorbed so much Indian culture, incredible amounts of Indian culture. It's only since from the 1950s onwards that India and China became rivals, adversaries, because the Chinese captured Tibet. And our weak-kneed government allowed that to happen in the 1950s. The great, magnificent Mr. Nehru. So the solution to how do you bring about India-China lasting peace? It's only by liberating Tibet, by making Tibet independent. So that is something India will have to find a way of doing. So until then, there's the situation. China is going to be an ever-present threat on India's border, northern border, the Himalayan border. And we can never trust China. We have to become stronger economically and militarily. And, you know, BRICS and all is nice, but overall, after at the end of the day, it is your nation first. So that's where we are. So BRICS, I would say that it's just like SAARC. SAARC is the South Asian Association of Regional Cooperation or whatever it is called, yeah? SAARC is a non-starter now. It is essentially a dead organization. Why? Because it contains India and Pakistan. As long as you have two major nations in a grouping of nations that are deeply adversarial to each other, that coalition or grouping of nations is a non-starter. It's non-viable. It just won't work. So BRICS may be going possibly in that direction. I mean, various nations want to be part of BRICS, but they may also choose to, you know, work with China separately. And of course, there is the talk of BRICS currency and all that. So that may also be good for India. So we will have to find ways of making certain things work. But overall, China is India's number one adversary, India's number one threat. And that is a given. We can never take our eyes off that fact. So that is the deal with China and what happened. right? Now let's talk of something else that happened recently. Amid the border tensions with China, something else happened. So what happened? Let's talk about the missile test. Where is the missile test? Let's put that on the screen. The news report. Where is it? Here it is. The news report. So amid border tensions with China, India successfully tests the Agni 5 missile. That's what the Hindustan Times says. The test was carried out to validate new technologies and equipment on the missile, which is now lighter, and so on and so forth. Yeah, the Agni 5 missile, it says, night trials. It doesn't matter whether you do a trial at night or day. Missile launches are, they don't care whether it's night or day. So it's a missile that's capable of hitting targets beyond 5,000 kilometers with a very high level of accuracy. Another report here. India successfully tests the Agni 5. Is it a warning to China and so on? So here is the range of the missile. This is the NOTAM that India had given out about roughly 2 weeks before the test. Yeah. So the missile splashed down all the way south, almost south of Madagascar and west of Australia. That 5,400 kilometers was the range of this missile, right? And if you talk about the Agni missile range, these are the various ranges, Agni 2, Agni 3, Agni 5. So Agni 5 is kind of what matches that range, yeah? 5,000, 5,500 kilometers, that sort of thing. And as you can see, it can pay a friendly visit to various capital cities around the world, including, obviously, our best friends in Beijing, including our good friends in Constantinople, Istanbul, including our very good friends in Moscow, including our wonderful friends in Tokyo, and so on. We never want to do that, but yeah, the capability exists. So this is the Agni missile range. The Agni 5 is the one with the largest range thus far. Now, so various interesting things were seen. For instance, there was this is very strange. Yeah, the missile was fired. It was launched from the coast of Odisha. Yeah, and it was seen from Mizoram's capital Aizawl, the capital of Mizoram in the far east of India. It was also seen from Manipur. Yeah, people saw it from Manipur. There are reports that it was seen from West Bengal, and there are also reports, video evidence, that it was seen from Myanmar. Myanmar, would you believe it? So this is an image of this is, I think, from Aizawl in the far east, the northeast of India. You can see some what looks like stage separation. There's a different image which also kind of looks like stage separation. How on earth can a missile that is launched from Odisha and that goes south, how on earth was it seen from Mizoram, from Manipur, from Myanmar? As you can see, Myanmar is really far away, and yet they were able to see it. So that's kind of strange, yes? And the other question is that, was this really the Agni 5? Now, first of all, please understand that I have no inside information. I am not in contact with any government agencies, with any of the scientists, with anybody. Whatever I'm saying is just open source speculation. So was this really the Agni 5, or was it some other missile that was fired? It appears that the trajectory of the missile was a depressed trajectory. So missiles can take a lot of trajectories. You know, if you want to do a very, very rough and somewhat incorrect approximation of a missile launch, you can think of a projectile motion. I think it's something you taught in basic physics, right? In high school, you taught Newtonian physics. That is, you first taught what is motion in one dimension, yeah? And then you taught projectile motion. So projectile motion is essentially like firing a bullet in the air or firing a shell or a cannonball into the air. So that takes a parabolic trajectory. So a very rough approximation of a ballistic trajectory, which is actually quite wrong, but you can use it as an approximation, is ballistic is projectile motion. So if you have projectile motion, then you will see that the missile can take a different variety of paths in the air. Now, it appears that this missile took a very depressed path. You know, it did not go very high above the atmosphere. Yeah, it kind of maybe skimmed the atmosphere, just above the atmosphere, and then re-entered if that is the case, then it would mean that this missile has certain capabilities that we were not aware of, possibly. And maybe the range also may not be exactly 5.5 thousand kilometers. It may be a different, the actual capability of the missile may be something else. So we know that the Agni-5 has a stated range of about 5,500 kilometers. The Chinese allege that it has an 8,000 or 9,000 kilometer range. That's what they have been alleging. We have never substantiated the Chinese allegations. We may also have certain other missiles that are currently being baked in the oven. Yeah, certain other missiles that may be under development. So the question is, what missile was this? And the official reports, even the various government ministers, not the defense minister, but other ministers have said it was the Agni-5. So there is a bit of ambiguity that we have maintained here, and it's a good thing. So I would say that we should not jump to the conclusion that it was the Agni-5. It could have been something else. It could have been a hypersonic glide vehicle. It could have been who knows what. But yeah, so, and the other question, so the first thing is that it could have been some other missile, possibly. It could have been an actual ICBM, you know, 8,000, 10,000 kilometer range. You can test an intercontinental ballistic missile in such a way that it travels only 4,000 or 5,000 kilometers. There are various ways of doing it. Either you change the trajectory, make it go high up in the atmosphere and drop down closer to you, or you could maybe put less fuel into it or whatever, you know, modify it in certain ways so as to fool the world. So I'm not sure which missile was tested. The official version is the Agni-5. All right, great. But it could possibly have been something else. But of course, please remember, I have no actual access to any privileged information. So I'm just speculating here. So the first thing is that it may have been some other missile, or maybe the Agni-5, whichever it is. So that's one thing, right? So that is about the Agni-5. And so the Agni-5, first of all, this is not the first. If it was actually the Agni-5, then it is not the first time that the Agni-5 has been tested. The Agni-5 has been tested multiple times since 2012. But the range has never been that long. Yeah. So that's the thing. So it could have been the Agni-5. It could have been something else. But the Agni-5 is a well-tested missile. It may actually have already been deployed, incorporated into the armed forces. Yeah. So the defense minister did not make any statement about the missile launch. The DRDO also did not make any statement, official statement about the launch. Various other ministers, Indian government ministers, have spoken about this. Yeah, that the Agni-5 has been tested. So that's the deal. That's what happened. So my point is that it could have been some other missile. It could have been the Agni-5. And this was not in response to the Chinese aggression at the border. Because the Chinese aggression at the border happened sometime about a week or so ago. But this missile launch, the NOTAM, was given more than 2 weeks ago. So it's not like India knew that the Chinese are going to do so-and-so thing and so-and-so date. This was already announced. And the Chinese spy ship, the electronic surveillance ship, I don't know what it's called, the Yuang Wang or whatever it's called. It was supposed to come into the Indian Ocean region to monitor the missile test. I'm not sure what happened. Maybe that is possibly the reason why the missile may have had a depressed trajectory, not a high trajectory, but a atmospheric skimming trajectory, so as to stay below the range of the instruments or whatever. So a whole lot of things could have happened here. But what has been officially announced is that it was the Agni-5. And whichever missile it was, it has been tested successfully. It has, whatever new technologies were tested, have been tested successfully. So overall, it's been a success for India. And it kind of tells the world that, you know, we have this capability. We are not showing a larger range. We are not testing a missile at the larger range. But this range for now is enough. We can target very important capital cities across Eurasia. And maybe more. So that's the message that has gone out to the world from this missile test. So that's the deal with the with this latest missile test. Now, another interesting thing was seen as a result of this missile test. So this was not seen as a result of the missile test, but it was seen in the aftermath of the India-China clash along the India-Tibet border. So somebody tweeted out that an MQ-9B drone was witnessed. There is this website, it's called flightradar24.com, on which you have all this open source information that anybody in the world can see. It's not, there's nothing secret there. So you can see various aircraft at any given point in time, which are what the aircraft that are flying anywhere in the world. Let me open that website for a second. Flightradar24.com. Let's put that on the screen, shall we? Let's put that on the screen. So let us go to that. Yeah. So let's understand what's happening here. So this is a live, essentially a live telecast of all the flights that are happening across the world right now. You can see it. Every single flight that is whose data is openly available in the open domain, you know, public source data. So you can actually take a look, you know, click on any aircraft and you can see where it came from and where it's going and so on. This is a Singapore Airlines flight from Zurich to Singapore. This is from Chongqing to Dubai. It's an Air China flight. What is this? This is a Emirates flight from Bangkok to Dubai and so on. You get the point, right? What I'm saying. So now the thing is this. So a day or so after the day or two after the India-China border clash, somebody tweeted that they witnessed a certain aircraft, a Q9. It's called Q9. So I took some screenshots. So this is something that's available in the public domain. There is nothing secret about this. Okay, the world can see this, and it was obviously seen by the world. So this aircraft was seen flying around Uttarakhand. Yeah, it's a Q. It's called Q9, and then later you could see it go all the way down south. So that's a long, long distance this aircraft flew. So this is the MQ-9B Sky Guardian, right? And it did not give any other information where it came from and all that, but this is the MQ-9B Sky Guardian. It is a hunter-killer drone. It has an endurance of 40 hours in all types of weather. It can safely integrate into civilian airspace and all that. It can fire missiles, it can do surveillance and much more. This is the General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper, but the MQ-9B is called the Predator, I think. It's called the Predator. Let's search for it. Q9B, where is the Q9B? 9B. There is a certain variant, the MQ-9B and so on. So India has that one, right? This is the Wikipedia article. So now if you look at this article from the Hindu, this is from August 22, okay, this year. It says that India is in an advanced stage of talks with the US for procuring MQ-9B drones. The MQ-9 Reaper that was used to launch a modified version of the Hellfire missile that eliminated Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. So the Hindu reported in late August, that India was in advanced stage of talks to acquire this drone. Now look at this. This is an article from Swarajya from May 28, which is before August. May, June, July, August, 4 months before August. Yeah. This Swarajya article says that Indian Navy's MQ-9B drones seen in satellite imagery for the first time on Indian soil. So the Swarajya magazine had reported in May that India already has acquired at least two of these drones. And then these guys in Hindu, 4 months later, are still reporting that India is in talks with the US to acquire these drones. That kind of tells you the quality of reporting in the Hindu. Anyhow, so the point is that India has, it looks like, at least two of these aircraft. Yeah. And if you read the article, it will tell you where these aircraft are situated, which base they are situated in. And obviously, if you had been tracking this drone, you would have found that it did indeed go to that particular location. So the point is that India has acquired this very advanced and very very capable drone from the US, and it was being deployed along the India-Tibet border in light of the recent tensions with China. Interesting. So this is a drone that can be flown for more than 40, at least 40 hours continuously. It can fly over the ocean. It can take out naval targets. And you can launch it from southern India and deploy it for, I don't know, 10, 12, 20 hours in the Himalayas and then bring it back to southern India. That's the kind of capability this drone has. Wonderful. So the Americans do have good technology, and it's good that we have acquired this. So it's going to add more teeth to our capabilities, and that's what we are doing. So it's a very interesting little thing that I witnessed, and I kind of tracked the drone for several hours just to see where it is going. I thought it'll land somewhere in northern India, maybe in, I don't know, Kanpur or Lucknow or something. But it went all the way into the Indian Ocean, long sortie over the Indian Ocean, and then it landed at its air base in somewhere in southern India. If you read the Swaraj article, you will know where it was. So once again, I am not giving any secret information. It's all available in the public domain, and military experts will know way more than this. I'm just giving you, you know, for your understanding, this information. So that is about the MQ-9B drone that India has acquired. Now, let's talk about the situation in Ukraine, because that is very relevant to what's going on in the world right now. So what's happening in Ukraine? So I have been predicting that maybe this winter, the winter is almost here now, it's more or less officially here now. So I said that after the Rasputitsa season is over, in winter properly sets in, when general winter sets in, that's when Russia will most likely, possibly, launch a major winter offensive in Ukraine. Yeah. So what's happening right now in the Ukraine situation? Let's take a look at that. Here we are. So this is from December 16. That's like yesterday. Russia launches another major missile attack on Ukraine. So Russia's bombardment campaign against Ukrainian cities continued unabated Friday with a major strike that sent dozens of missiles aimed at Kiev. The Ukrainian capital's air defenses claim to have knocked out the majority of incoming fire, shooting down 37 of estimated incoming 40 rockets. In total, Ukraine's military claimed that it had shot down 60 of the 76 missiles. So they are claiming that they are knocking down all the missiles, but it's clear that the Russians are launching major waves of missile strikes across Ukraine. That's why I said that one of the major lessons of the Ukraine war is that you need to have a huge stockpile of missiles. Yeah. This is a Defense of Ukraine Twitter account. It says Russia launched its ninth massive terrorist missile attack on Ukraine today. Same thing, out of 76, 60 were shot down. Yeah. But it's clear that the Russians are targeting Ukraine's electricity infrastructure, the electricity grid. Yeah. And what is the consequence of that? Let's take a look at this. Net blocks. Metrics show that today's Russian missile attacks have resulted in a loss of connectivity and power in multiple regions of Ukraine, with authorities reporting 9 energy generation facilities damaged as a result of today's attack, with 76 missiles counted at the last update. Confirmed, network data shows a significant disruption to internet connectivity in Ukraine, corresponding to power cuts amid new Russian missile attacks targeting critical infrastructure. National connectivity is at 68% of previous levels. So the Russians are targeting the Ukrainian power grid. The Ukrainian power grid is said to be now operating at less than 50% of capacity. And there's, as you can see, there is a significant disruption to the internet connectivity in Ukraine. What else is happening? Okay, now this is a website called, this is a account called Critical Threats. It says that Russia may be setting conditions to conduct a new offensive against Ukraine, possibly against Kiev, in winter 2023. Such an attack is extraordinarily unlikely to succeed. That's fine. That's your opinion. A Russian attack from Belarus is not imminent at this time. So they are also now, the Americans are now also coming, saying this publicly, stating this, that there could be a winter offensive against Ukraine. Winter 23, maybe late December 22, we don't know. Let's see. That's for Mr. Putin to decide. And they are saying that a Russian attack from Belarus is not imminent at this time. And now we see this. Belarus begins snap combat readiness drills. What does that mean? Here's more. Belarus begins snap combat readiness drills on the order of the country's president, Lukashenko. So yeah, the Belarus, which essentially is a Russian ally, it is now indulging in these snap readiness drills. So let's take a look at Belarus. Where is Belarus so that we understand the situation? Ah, here's the map. Okay, so we know where Moscow is. That's the capital of Russia. We know where Ukraine is. This is the nation that is we are talking about. And here is Belarus. So the Western nations, NATO, they are funneling arms, ammunition, all that into Ukraine via Poland, mainly via Poland. And east of Poland, you have Belarus, which is north of Ukraine. So Belarus has a very important geographical position in this geostrategic chessboard. And the Belarus armed forces are now conducting military drills, readiness drills. And Belarus obviously is allied with Moscow. Yeah. So that is what is happening. Now, the Institute for the Study of War, it's an American thing, a think tank. It says that Belarusian forces remain unlikely to attack Ukraine despite a snap Belarus military readiness check today. They're claiming it's unlikely to happen. Fine, that's fine. And somebody is saying this is potentially very meaningful. I've seen dozens of videos of trains carrying Russian heavy equipment over the past several weeks. I've seen lots of recent train videos of Belarusian equipment. Here we have a train containing both. So it looks like the militaries of Belarus and Russia are coordinating, collaborating, and even combining their military supplies together, which is ominous. So there could be something that could happen from Belarus territory as well, you see. Because if the Russians make a move from the south, maybe towards Odessa, this major port here, then there could be a diversionary attack from Belarus as well or something like that. So there may be some coordination that could be about to happen between Russia and Belarus in what could be a potential winter offensive. Or maybe it's just a diversion for NATO. Or maybe it's a diversion, or maybe they would want to shut down the Poland-Ukraine border to prevent NATO from funneling arms and ammunition and supplies into Ukraine. So there are various possibilities, but now Belarus seems to have been activated as a pawn in the geostrategic chessboard. So that is something that we need to keep in mind. It could come into play over the next days and weeks. Yep. Here's an interesting piece of news. The Pentagon has given Ukraine the green light for drone strikes inside Russia. And indeed, the Ukrainians carried out certain drone strikes deep into Russian territory. For instance, a drone struck an airfield in the Russian region of Kursk this week. I wonder how the Russians could respond to this. Will this not lead to escalations? But anyway, that's something that's happening. The Pentagon has given Ukraine green light to launch drone strikes into Russian territory. Now look at this. Let's talk about Bakhmut. This is from the Hindustan Times. This is from yesterday. Ukraine's military is collapsing in Bakhmut. Vicious assault deals the Ukrainian military a heavy blow. So what is Bakhmut? Where is Bakhmut? Bakhmut is here. It is essentially on the front line between the Donbas region that Russia now controls and Ukrainian held territory. Yeah, so there is this massive battle, this offensive that's been going on in this one city, Bakhmut, for the past several weeks. And various commentators are calling it the Bakhmut meat grinder. It appears that the Ukrainians are suffering incredibly heavy casualties in Bakhmut. Yeah. So now here's something interesting. So the Bakhmut, like I said, they're calling it the Bakhmut meat grinder. This is a Western publication, The Guardian, which is from the UK. Yeah. And this is a headline from the New York Times. It's from September 17. Yeah. Today is what? Today is December 17. This is from 2 months ago. So in September 17, The New York Times was saying that Russia closes in on a critical city in Ukraine's east, which was Bakhmut. Okay, they were calling it a critical city in September. Now, what is the West saying? The Bakhmut meat grinder. This is a Radio Free Europe or whatever. Russian troops are pummeling this Donbas city, and it's unclear why. This is from December 13, 3 days ago, 4 days ago. in September, it was a critical city. Now, the West is wondering, why are the Russians doing it? What's the point of Bakhmut? See, lots of Voice of America. Russia investing large amount of its military might in Ukraine's Bakhmut. Fox News. Russia invests disproportionately costly offensive to take Bakhmut despite low strategic value. Low strategic value? How did it become low strategic value when in September it was critical? New York Post. Russia puzzles with costly fight for small city of Bakhmut, Ukraine. So now that Russia is succeeding, they are saying it is puzzling. See, Guardian says we are scratching our heads. We don't know why Russia is focusing on Bakhmut. In September, they knew it was a critical city. Now that the Russians are winning, they're saying we are wondering why it's happening. My point is, please don't trust the media. The media will twist the narrative to suit certain agendas. Always. In September, the New York Times was saying Bakhmut was a critical city. Now they are all claiming that it is puzzling. We are scratching our heads. Why is this insignificant city? Why are the Russians focusing so much on it? Right? So when the Russians attack a city, which is important, they will call it a critical city. When the Russians succeed, they will say it was a low-value target. I don't know why. We don't know why the Russians are doing it. So please understand this. I'm showing you this in real time, how the narrative changes very rapidly over a question of a couple of months. Yes? Do not trust the media. Look at multiple sources, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 sources, to get a proper idea of what's really happening. Yeah, look at social media accounts, maybe from small accounts also, people who are actually on the ground, reporting from the ground. Look at lots of different sources. They do a 360-degree perspective. Only then will you get some idea of what's really happening. And don't trust the big Western media outlets. They're lying to you. Yeah, September, it's critical. Now it's low value. How does it become low value? What's really happening is that Bakhmut city has turned into a complete meat grinder. It's a horrible term to use. It appears that tens of thousands of Ukrainian troops have lost their lives in this thing. It's degrading the strength of the Ukrainian military. And I'm not sure why the West is encouraging Ukraine to spend so many human lives over there. But that's what's happening. So that is the Bakhmut meat grinder. Yeah. It's not a head scratcher. It's not a mystery. It's a critical city and the Russians are winning it. And the Ukrainians are paying a hugely heavy price for it. Now, another thing that's happening is this. So the Americans have imposed this oil price cap on Russian oil. $60 per barrel, right? Now, here's something the Russians could do. They could say, okay, to various nations, European nations, Western nations, okay, you want to pay only $60 for the oil? That's fine. But you must pay it in gold, not in dollars. So we will sell you the oil at the price that you're setting. It's $60, but you must pay that $60 in gold, not in dollars. And they may even say, instead of one barrel, we will offer you two barrels for $60, but you must pay in gold. If they do it, then the price of gold will immediately double from $1,800 per gram or whatever it is, you know, an ounce, to $3,600 an ounce. And please understand that the Russian ruble is tied to the price of gold. It is, the Russian ruble is on the gold standard. So that would double immediately the price of the value of the Russian ruble. So that's the game that is being played. So the Russians may say, okay, you want to do this price cap game? Let's do it. But we will not take US dollars. We'll not take payment in US dollars. We'll take payment in gold. We'll give you double the amount of oil. But you must pay in gold. That will double the price of gold immediately in a very short time. And it will double the value of the Russian ruble as well. So these are the economic dealings that are going on. Yeah. So you can read this article. It's by Anna Golubova. And you can see if you want the link, it's over here. You can pause the video and take a look at it. Yeah. So that's the kind of thing that's happening. And now the other thing that's happening is that the world is now worrying about a possible worldwide conflict. What do we mean by a possible worldwide conflict? We are talking of WW3, World War III. So there's this Ipsos survey for Halifax International Security Forum. It has found that 73% of people on average across 53 nations expect that in the next 25 years, we could see another world conflict involving superpowers or major powers, similar to World Wars 1 and 2. And this is the thing, you know, the major nations from their perspective are the ones in blue and red, the US and Canada. And you can see that most people believe that most in most nations, a significant percentage of people believe that there's going to be a major war. For India, it's 79%. For Australia, it's 81%. What about China? China is down here, 64%. Japan is 51%. The Japanese people, I don't know what's happened to them. They seem to be living in some under some kind of delusion. But that's what it is. So now it is becoming, I mean, people are more and more believing, they're believing more and more that we could be in a situation that could lead to a World War III kind of situation within the next 25 years or maybe sooner. So that's the situation right now. The world is becoming more pessimistic as this conflict becomes further drawn out. It goes on and various other geopolitical tensions continue. The India-China flashpoint, the North Korea flashpoint, the China-Japan issue, the Chinese claims on Japanese islands, the Chinese claims on various territories with its various neighbors, the Japan-Russia territorial dispute, the Kuril Islands, and so many other things. There are many flashpoints in the world right now, and all these things are there. Yeah, so people are becoming more pessimistic, and people are expecting that maybe the world is inching towards a World War III kind of scenario. Now, let's talk about one more thing. Let's talk about Angela Merkel. So these days, it's almost like every week there's a new embarrassing statement by a NATO leader or, you know, a Western leader. A couple of weeks ago, it was Ursula von der Leyen, who made the embarrassing revelation that more than 100,000 Ukrainian military personnel have so far lost their life in the Ukraine conflict. More than 100,000. That's a huge number. And then that video was quickly pulled down. It was edited and that portion was cut out. So that's what happened. Now there's a new interview that's come out. An interview with the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel. That interview is now in just 2-3 days, it's disappeared. It's no longer available anywhere. It was a video interview with a German news organization. I think it was with DW. That interview is it can no longer be found online. Unless, I don't know, I was not able to find it. And that news has been scrubbed. So what did the lady say? Let's find out what she said. So this is modern diplomacy. It says Merkel's confession could be a pretext for an international tribunal. But what was the confession? It was their Die Zeit. Speaking in her interview for Die Zeit, published on December 7, German ex-Chancellor Merkel said the following. The 2014 Minsk Agreement was an attempt to buy time for Ukraine. Ukraine used this time to become stronger, as we can see today. Ukraine in 2014, 2015, and Ukraine today are not the same. According to the ex-chancellor, it was clear to everyone, apparently, that the conflict was suspended and the problem was not resolved, but it was exactly what gave Ukraine priceless time. What was the Minsk Agreement? So the Minsk Agreement had, like, I don't know, 11, 12, 13, 14 points. I think 13 points or so. It was an agreement between Russia and the West. It was an agreement between Russia and Ukraine mediated by the West. Mediated by Russia, mediated by Germany and France, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And the first Minsk Agreement was in 2014. It failed very rapidly. Then there was a new Minsk 2 in 2015. That also failed. And it failed because both sides did not agree to various terms. And I will not open the terms and all that. It will become a very long, drawn-out thing. But it was an agreement that the Russians signed with Ukraine with the mediation of the West. Now, it's now clear from this goof-up by this revelation by the lady that this was merely a ploy to buy time for Ukraine, which means the West was already clear that there's going to be a war in Ukraine. and they were going to push Ukraine to the brink of war through their actions, and they knew that the Russians would eventually have no option but to go to war. So in 2014, there was the Maidan coup in Ukraine. The Americans placed a puppet government in Ukraine. There was a brief period of time when there was no government in Ukraine, and that's when the Russians took Crimea. That's when the Russians captured Crimea. It looks like the Russians should have captured Donbass and other parts of Ukraine too at that time itself. Instead of doing that, they sat down on the negotiating table and they were fooled. So lots of Indians think that Mr. Putin is infallible. He is this superhuman, superhero person. Well, he was played for a fool, especially by Angela Merkel. Because Putin seems to have a great deal of regard for the lady. He has known her ever since she became the chancellor, like in the mid-2000s. Yeah. So they fooled Vladimir Putin. If he had taken Donbass and various parts of Ukraine at that time, I don't think the West could have gotten involved the way it is involved right now. And this gave Ukraine, from 2014 to 2022, nearly 8 years, a period of time in which it was able to significantly bolster its military capabilities with the help of the West. So they all got together to fool Vladimir Putin. Yeah. And now Putin says that he is disappointed by Merkel's words about the Minsk agreements. I think he should be more disappointed about being so gullible and being made a fool of. So we say that Indians are easy to fool. The Indian leadership at various points in time has trusted, let's say, China and trusted other countries, and we have been betrayed, backstabbed. Well, here we have Vladimir Putin trusting the West, trusting Angela Merkel, trusting NATO, being so gullible, and now he is feeling that, like, he has been backstabbed after what Merkel revealed a week or so ago. So here we have the great Vladimir Putin. It has been now revealed that he was played for a fool. He was fooled, completely fooled. He trusted NATO. He trusted the leaders of NATO. There is no trust in geopolitics. There are no friends in geopolitics. Maybe he should pay attention to what I say from time to time. So there you have the great Vladimir Putin was fooled by NATO. How interesting is that? Yeah. So that's about that. Now let's talk about one more thing before we end. Let's talk about Twitter. Twitter files is a big deal these days. The US mainstream media is not covering the Twitter files revelations at all. They're keeping very quiet. Very quiet. But yeah, the rest of the world is noticing what's happening. So there have been like 4 or 5 installments of the Twitter files. Yeah. And one of the main protagonists or the main journalists who has been reporting about the Twitter files is a lady called Barry Weiss. Yeah. So let's put on the screen something she tweeted, Barry Weiss. So she went on this, she has created this Twitter thread in which she has revealed lots of things. Recently, I think yesterday it was revealed that Twitter had become an extension of the FBI, more or less. They were taking orders from the FBI and they were doing whatever they were being told. So it means that Twitter was an extension of the US deep state. Let's use the term deep state. What is the deep state? It is the true power in the US. The US president doesn't really have much power unless that president is mentally competent and in line with the agenda of the deep state. Currently, we have a president who is not very mentally competent and a vice president who is clueless. And in the past, we have had presidents like Mr. Kennedy who were against the agenda of the truth of the deep state, and we know what happened to them. So Twitter had become a geopolitical extension of the deep state. The deep state of the US was using Twitter for its geopolitical, to further its geopolitical agenda. Now, over here, Barry Weiss talks about the kind of bias that Twitter had, that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei tweeted that Israel needs to be destroyed, and Twitter did not ban him. Yeah. She speaks about Mahathir Mohamad, who said that the Muslims should kill millions of French people, and his account was not banned. And she talks about the president of Nigeria who incited violence. Twitter deleted the tweet but did not ban him. The Ethiopian prime minister called on citizens to take arms against Tigray on Twitter, and the tweet was allowed to remain up, and the Prime Minister was not banned, and so on. And then she talks about Prime Minister Modi. In early February 21, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government threatened to arrest Twitter employees in India and to incarcerate them for up to 7 years after they restored hundreds of accounts that had been critical of him. Twitter did not ban Modi. And she is not tweeting, she's not putting a screenshot of a tweet by Mr. Modi, which does anything like what the others have done. Instead, she is putting a screenshot of a New York Times fake news article. Yeah, she worked for the New York Times and she has said that the New York Times is not good, but she conveniently put a screenshot of a New York Times headline, which was a fake news headline. And she doesn't refer to New York Times in this tweet. So she's essentially peddling more fake news here. And this was like, you know, the Indian government responded, this is fake news. The government of India, led by Prime Minister Modi, said that all have to follow the law of the land and any non-compliance will lead to loss of exemption from liability as intermediate status under IT Act. There were no arrest threats. These are the facts. So Barry Weiss is lying. This is outright blatant fake news that she is putting out. When it comes to the other leaders, that she's giving actual evidence. So all of this is real news, but with respect to India, she's putting out fake news. And the Indian government responded and put out the facts. And then once again, we have this article. So once again, the mainstream Indian media, whether it is the print or the squint or the Hindu or whatever else, they have completely kept quiet about this. It is Op India that has written about this, that Barry Weiss uses a misleading New York Times report to make false claims about Modi government's warning to Twitter to follow Indian law. Twitter has to follow Indian law in India. Is that something wrong? On the one hand, we have various leaders like Mahathir Mohamad who are calling for killing of millions. We have Khomeini who's asking for the destruction of Israel, and the Modi government is asking for Twitter to follow Indian law. How can you equate these things? There is clear malice in this tweet. There are certain intellectual Indian commentators who have said that this is stupidity. It is not malice. I'm sorry. This is not stupidity on the part of Barry Weiss. This is outright malice. She could not find any tweet that she could put out like she's done over here. So she put out a fake news report and she's lying over here. This is a lie. This is an outright lie. The facts are known. The facts are out here. The facts are listed in great detail in this article. So Barry Weiss, who Elon Musk, see, here's the question. Why did Elon Musk trust unhinged, vacuous ex-New York Times airhead Barry Weiss to report on the Twitter files? I may have used a slightly strong language, but that's fine. Her actions aren't stupid, like some people have suggested. Her track record, numerous data points, reveals bias and malice. For instance, there is this clip on the Joe Rogan podcast in which she launches a baseless assault on Tulsi Gabbard. Barry Weiss, in this clip, she calls Tulsi Gabbard a monstress, and she calls Tulsi Gabbard a Assad toady without any evidence. And when Joe Rogan asks for the evidence, she's not able to provide any. Joe Rogan even asks his guy, what's his name, the guy who assists him, to find some evidence and put on the screen. There is none. Yeah. So she has a track record of lying. She is not a trustworthy journalist. She is not a serious journalist. She cannot be taken seriously. And Elon Musk has trusted her to report on the Twitter files. So that raises the question as to why has Elon Musk, one of the most intelligent people in the world, trusted somebody as questionable as Barry Weiss to report on the Twitter files? And now more revelations have come out about the Twitter files. That, let's see what revelations have come out. Twitter files, this one here, the new one. So Twitter had become an FBI subsidiary. Twitter was very much part of the US deep state and the deep state operations worldwide. Now Elon Musk has taken over and he's trying to, you know, put out the facts about how Twitter was corrupt, how Twitter was biased and all that. And yet he has trusted Barry Weiss, who is not trustworthy, to report on this. And she has gone ahead and reported maliciously fake news about India and the Indian government. So the question is, what's going on? Is Elon Musk stupid? I don't think he's stupid. He's one of the most intelligent people in the world. So then what's going on? That's the question. So the truth is, the truth possibly could be that now that the whole world knows, by now the whole world knows that Twitter was deeply corrupt, deeply biased, deeply prejudiced. And the whole world more or less also knows that Twitter indulged in significant electoral interference in the 2020 presidential elections in the US. Everyone knows this now. They favored the Democrats and tried to hinder the Republican campaign. They even banned a sitting president of the US. Yeah, incredible. So everyone knows that Twitter indulged in blatant electoral interference, which means that the 2020 election was not a free and fair election. In the US, they call themselves a democracy. First of all, there are two-party state. And secondly, there is electoral interference from the deep state. So the deep state wanted to make the Democrats win, and they wanted Trump to lose. The deep state wanted that. And Twitter was one of the major weapons in this. Yeah. So now the world knows that 2020 is a questionable election. Trump has been saying that for the longest time. Now the whole world knows it by now. And the world also knows that Twitter was deeply, deeply biased. So this could be the Twitter fires, all these revelations. They are not bringing out something shocking. They are bringing out facts that the world essentially already knew. Some data points are like, you know, interesting. But overall, the picture that's been painted is what we already suspected or already knew all these years. Nothing really new is coming out. So this could be an attempt to actually whitewash Twitter's reputation and make it seem to the world that Twitter can now be trusted. Yeah? And to kind of whitewash the reputation of the US overall by bringing Twitter under a new custodian. And maybe Twitter will still continue to be used as a tool, a weapon of the US deep state. I can promise you that nothing significantly incendiary will come out on the Twitter files. Nothing that will actually point to the real people who hold true power in the US. Nothing of that sort will come out. Yeah? Yeah, even the COVID files are going to come out. Elon Musk has said that he is going to go after Fauci, Dr. Anthony Fauci and all. The whole world knew more than a year ago that Anthony Fauci was a fraud. So he's just going to confirm that for you. That's it. So it looks like the Twitter files are a whitewashing operation to make the people believe now, worldwide, that now Twitter is going to run smoothly and it's no longer corrupt and it's under the right leadership. I can assure you that Elon Musk also cannot reveal certain things that the deep state, the FBI or whatever, doesn't want him to reveal. Yeah? So yeah, they have thrown Vijaya Gadde under the bus. She deserves it. Yeah? Crooked lady. They've thrown, to some extent, Jack Dorsey under the bus, to some extent, not so much, but yeah, no one liked him anyway. People were sick of him. So yeah, that too. And Anthony Fauci, yeah. So they are essentially getting rid of the trash. But Twitter is still going to firmly remain under deep state control, I assure you. Yeah. So that's the deal. So, and you know, Elon Musk may mean well. He may believe in free speech. His real agenda is to reach Mars. The other stuff is all, a sideshow, essentially. So one must not place too much trust in Elon Musk, too much trust in Twitter. We have to take all these revelations with a spoonful of salt, because there's a whole lot that is not being revealed and which will not ever be revealed. Don't trust blindly. Never trust anyone blindly. All right? So, that brings me to the end of today's session, today's episode of The Indian Interest. I hope it was valuable, useful. I hope you learned something. Thank you for watching, and I will see you in less than 24 hours. Tomorrow, we have the latest episode of the Ask Abhijit Show. Tomorrow, it's going to be at 8 p.m. Indian time. 8 p.m. Indian time, not 9 p.m. as usual. I'm going to be watching the World Cup final match, and I'll answer questions in between. I'll take questions from the comments, I'll take questions from the live chat, and I'm going to watch the World Cup final, and we can have a nice discussion, conversation tomorrow. So that is tomorrow on the Ask a Bit show. So until then, take care, and I will see you tomorrow very soon. Take care. Thank you very much. Bye.